Yeah, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson heads to Moscow for talks on a range of issues, including Syria. White House spokesman Sean Spicer said despite Russian ally Syria's use of chemical weapons last week, Tillerson will still be looking for ways to cooperate against Islamic State.
There's no question who acted in this case and what Syria did. And I think that we need to make sure that Russia fully understands the actions that Assad took, the commitments that Syria has made, and Russia has equally agreed to those same, you know, understanding. So getting them back on the same page, first and foremost, would seem the logical step. But secondly, and I guess, you know, equally as important, is to make sure that the areas where we can find a commitment to defeat ISIS is something that we share.
At a G7 meeting in Italy Monday, British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said he believes Moscow needs a way out of that conflict.
If I think about the position of Vladimir Putin now, he's, you know, he's toxifying his the reputation of Russia by his continual association with a guy who has flagrantly poisoned his own people.
British Prime Minister Theresa May and President Donald Trump spoke by phone, agreeing that in light of last week's missile strike on a Syrian air base, a window of opportunity exists to persuade Russia to break ties with Mr. Assad. But analyst Alexei Moraviev of Australia's Curtin University said Russia will not easily abandon the Assad regime.
There may be an opportunity to negotiate a transition to a candidate who will be more moderate than Assad, suitable for the Russians, because the Russians have too much at stake in Syria.
Russia has rejected accusations the Syrian regime used chemical weapons against his own people. The UN Monday said at least 16 killed in South Sudan as militia targeted civilians based on their ethnicity in the town of Wau. This is VOA News. Egyptian security forces said they killed 7 suspected Islamic State sympathizers believed to be planning more attacks against Coptic Christians in the wake of Sunday's twin bombings of churches that killed 44 and wounded dozens more. Islamic State claimed responsibility. Monday's operation followed a 3-month state of emergency. Mona Makram Abed, a political science professor at American University in Cairo, said Christians are particularly targeted by the IS group.
And I tell you this because I think that the terrorists have not been able to overthrow the government as they wanted or to get over in their counterinsurgency against the police and the army. So the really weak part of this whole thing is to cause sectarian strife.
Meanwhile, families of the victims of Sunday's bombings gathered Monday at the monastery of St. Mina under heavy security. Sunday's targets, St. Mark's Cathedral in Alexandria, St. George's in Tanta, north of Cairo. Niger security forces said they killed nearly 60 members of Islamist insurgency Boko Haram, who attacked a village in southeast Diffa region. The defense ministry said 15 soldiers, 2 civilians, were wounded. Most of Boko Haram's attacks have occurred in Nigeria, but in recent years have spread to Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. U.S. officials, meanwhile, said the Trump administration is pushing forward with plans to sell aircraft to Nigeria to use in the fight against Boko Haram. They said the deal could be worth up to $600 million. The aircraft, identified as the Super Tucano A-29, propeller-driven planes with reconnaissance, surveillance, and attack capabilities. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres Monday designated Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai as the UN Messenger of Peace.
I am proud to designate you the youngest ever United Nations Messenger of Peace with a special focus on girls' education.
Yousafzai, the youngest ever Nobel Peace Prize laureate, receiving that international accolade in 2014 when she was just 17. She became an advocate for girls' education at the age of 11. At 15, she was brutally attacked by Taliban militants, suffering severe wounds. Police in San Bernardino, California, said a special education teacher, one of her students, were fatally shot Monday by her estranged husband after he opened fire in her classroom. The gunman then killed himself. Lieutenant Mike Madden is a police spokesman.
This does appear to have been a murder-suicide with both a male adult and female adult victim succumbing to injuries, with the male succumbing to a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
A second student was wounded near the site of a radical Muslim couple's mass shooting that left 14 dead in December 2015. Dylan Ruth, a self-proclaimed white supremacist, already sentenced to death in federal court for a 2015 shooting of 9 people in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm Victor
Beatty. That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Bate, Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Global Witness says it has uncovered what it calls one of the biggest corruption scandals in the oil industry involving Shell and Nigeria.
This is one of the biggest corruption scandals in the history of the oil industry. The investigation that Global Witness just published reveals how Shell has taken part in a massive bribery scheme which deprived Nigeria and its people of $1.1 billion.
Stephanie Osfeld is the deputy head of Global Witness's U.S. office. Gambian activists marked the anniversary of a student massacre 17 years ago. A court has charged Makerere University researcher Stella Nyanzi with cyber harassment of President Museveni. Cameroon grapples with barriers dividing French and English-speaking regions of the country, and at least 16 civilians were killed Monday in renewed fighting in South Sudan.
We have seen that many people are just pulled out of their room when they are recognized as Fatih, they are killed. When they are recognized as Lua, they are killed. In area where I am, around 4 people were killed on the spot.
Odongi Simon is a resident of Nazareth neighborhood of South Sudan, Wau Town, and armed groups in the Central African Republic occupy schools, preventing thousands of students from getting their education. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Global Witness says it has uncovered what it calls one of the biggest corruption scandals in the oil industry involving Shell Oil in Nigeria. In a new report released Monday, citing leaked emails, Global Witness says Shell management knew that money earmarked for the OPL-245 oil deal was going to be siphoned to Nigerian government officials, including former Petroleum Minister Dan Etete and then President Goodluck Jonathan. The OPL-245 is an oil field believed to be the largest in Africa. It was said to have been fraudulently acquired by Malibu Oil and Gas Limited in 1998 and sold to Shell and Agib. Nigeria's Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, the EFCC, has filed corruption charges against Shell and INA and 11 others. Stephanie Osfeld is the deputy head of Global Witness's U.S. office. She says Global Witness has asked the U.S. Justice Department to investigate whether Shell has violated the U.S. Foreign Corruption Practices Act.
This is one of the biggest corruption scandals in the history of the oil industry, and this is really the biggest development so far. The investigation that Global Witness just published reveals how Shell has taken part in a massive bribery scheme which deprived Nigeria and its people of $1.1 billion. So the story is that back in 2011, Shell and its partner Eni, they paid $1.1 billion for one of Africa's biggest oil blocks. So it's known as OPL-245. And this is money that's desperately needed in Nigeria, where 5 million people currently face starvation and 1 in 10 kids don't see their fifth birthday. But they didn't see the benefits. Instead, what our investigation shows is that there are leaked emails which show that Shell's most senior executives knew that its massive payment would go to a convicted money launderer and the former oil minister named Dan Etete. Shell also knew, their executives also understood, that money from this deal was likely to flow to some of the most powerful people in the country, including then-President Goodluck Jonathan.
Is Shell currently under investigation by the Nigerian government?
The Nigerian government, as well as a number of other governments, have been investigating Shell, as is Italy, where there's a court case that will proceed, that Shell will be in Italy for this court case around April 20th.
Does Shell currently have this particular oil deal that we are talking about?
They currently do, but it's been in court, and Nigeria was trying to take it back, so that is an ongoing case to watch.
With your revelation now, what do you hope to come out of this revelation?
Actually, there's been a new development today. In addition to what we exposed yesterday about how senior executives knew that the money paid for oil block OPL-245 would go to a convicted money launderer and had reason to believe that it would also, some of that money, reach the former president, today Shell has shifted its position on this issue. For the last 6 years, Shell's denied that it did anything wrong. It said it paid only the Nigerian government in securing rights to the block. But these emails show that they knew this money was going to be diverted anyway. But actually, what they said today in response in a statement to the New York Times that also published on this earlier today was that they wrote that over time it became clear to us that Etete was involved in Malibu, which is the name of the company that got the oil block, and that the only way to resolve the impasse was through a negotiated settlement was to engage with Etete and Malibu, whether we liked it or not. The spokesperson for Shell said that they knew the Nigerian government would compensate Malibu to settle its claim on the block. And so this is actually a huge U-turn that reveals, you know, Shell's duplicity in this deal, because for the last 6 years they've asserted it only paid the Nigerian government, insisting they've been nothing but transparent about the deal for the oil block and that its actions were morally okay. So these new facts raise serious questions about whether Shell was in violation of a number of anti-bribery bills, including the United States Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And so we're urging the Department of Justice to investigate this. We're urging the U.S. and the U.K. And other countries with knowledge and information about the deal to work with the Italian authorities that are currently working on this case.
Stephanie Osfeld is the deputy head of Global Witness's U.S. office. She was speaking with me in Washington. For the first time in 17 years, Gambian activists and victims of an April 2000 student massacre have commemorated the anniversary in grand style and demanding justice for their slain colleagues. Sidney Mariner reports from the Gambian capital, Banjul.
This is the gate of the Gambia Technical Training Institute, GTTI, just outside Banjul. Right here at around 8 a.m. on the fateful day of April 10, 2000, dozens of students, including executive members of the then Gambia Student Union, GAMSU, started gathering to stage a street protest. By 9:30, the number jumped to 100, and there they took to the street, chanting and singing for justice. A few days earlier, a young female student was allegedly raped by uniformed police officers in the provincial part of the country. This was followed by alleged beating to death of a male student by officers of the fire and ambulance services in Brikama, about 32 kilometers away from Banjul. Seeking justice for the two students, the demonstrators peacefully marched from this spot towards the popular Westfield Square, less than 2 kilometers away, to express the grievances. By 11 a.m., armed military officers who were stationed outside to contain the protest started firing at protesters, killing some of them and arresting and beating many others. The news of the heavy-handedness spread across the country like wildfire, and before midday, thousands of students in other parts of the country also took to the street to vent anger and frustration at the authorities for the brutalities meted out to their colleagues. Among them is Amity, the Gambia's only boarding school located in the Central River region. A former student there recalled what happened on that fateful day.
My name is Lamin Osanyang. For us in Amity, we did it at night, the whole night, from 10 o'clock up to the dawn. You know, but at the end of it, it was very sad. It was really horrible. They caught us, beat us, you know, beat us with guns. In fact, we were taken to remind. We were taken to jail, but we were not fit in the jail. So they prepared a hostel inside Amity, the girls' hostel, and they kept all of us there. We suffered. They beat us both day and night. Even before you eat, they have to beat you, you eat. And after eating, they beat you.
For the first time in 17 years, the victims, their families and friends, and students from various schools on Monday returned to GTTI to celebrate the events of April 10 and 11, 2000.
Zainab Diab. I am in the executive committee of the victims committee for victims of Jambe's atrocities. And April 10 students are part of us. So this is a significant day. Since 2000 up to date, no one has ever dared to come out to make a peaceful demonstration or even voice out a single statement about the plight of these people. But today, for the first time, we are all out here to demonstrate peacefully, asking for justice for these youths.
Today's march is thanks to the change of rhythm from that of Yahya Jammeh, which had banned the commemoration, to that of Adama Barrow, which accepted and embraced the idea of the celebrations of events of April 10 and 11. As part of endorsement, senior state officials, including Minister of Information, Justice and Youth and Sport, were there to join the crowd of students. Reporting for VOA News, I am Seni Marina in Banjul.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 11th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A strike in English-speaking parts of Cameroon is approaching its 6th month. Schools in those areas remain shut and businesses paralyzed. As tensions deepen, Cameroon has begun grappling with some of the deeper grievances underpinning the unrest. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Another market was burned in an English-speaking area of Cameroon on Saturday. This time, it was in the northwestern town of Kumbu at St. Augustine's College Junction.
We don't run too long without seeing the premises of where the person...
Local businessman Dukong Gabriel estimates he lost $20,000 worth of property. He says he will no longer be capable of repaying his loan.
All union residents should come on board to grant some clemencies to all their clients under the granted loan before this crisis.
The government has blamed the fires on secessionist groups in English-speaking zones. The unrest in those areas, the northwest and southwest, began shortly after English-speaking lawyers and teachers went on strike in November, demanding reforms. The situation intensified as the strike pulled in other activists who say the English-speaking minority is marginalized and that those regions should declare total independence. The government has rejected secessionist discourse but announced some changes, including the recruitment of more bilingual teachers and more Anglophone judicial officers. Paul Nchojinkwi, anthropologist and social sciences lecturer at the Catholic University of Cameroon, Bamenda, says it will take deeper reform to calm tensions.
The strike of the teachers and the lawyers just open a Pandora's box, and there are lots of grievances which are now emerging.
Justice Minister Laurent Esso announced at the start of April that the government will propose draft legislation to address alleged marginalization in the court system. Cameroon has parallel legal systems inherited from its two former colonial rulers. Francophone regions follow the French legal tradition, while Anglophone areas use British common law.
Le président de la République a instruit d'élaborer et de lui soumettre un projet de loi.
Justice Minister Esso says President Paul Biya is very aware of the difficulties raised concerning Anglophones. He says, among other measures, Biya has asked for the elaboration of a draft law on the creation of a common law division at the Supreme Court to handle cases from the English-speaking parts of Cameroon. He says they have also been instructed to conduct a census of English-speaking lawyers to increase their representation at the higher levels of the judiciary. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The United Nations peacekeeping mission in South Sudan, known as OMIS, says at least 16 civilians were killed on Monday in the South Sudanese city of Wau. OMIS said in a statement that the violence apparently stemmed from an ambush on Sunday of government troops near Wau. Eyewitnesses say gunmen dressed in military uniform went on a massacre. They say gunmen who looked like government forces stormed houses, killed civilians, and looted property. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Odongi Simon, a resident of Wau's Nazareth neighborhood, says he did not understand why he was hearing the sound of random gunshots as he woke up this morning.
It started with the sound of gunshot round the areas of Nazareth, Haidafara, and those areas that are inhabited by the Luo and Patit in Wau. We have seen that many people are just pulled out of their room. When they are recognized as Patit, they are killed. When they are recognized as Luo, they are killed. In area where I am, around 4 people were killed on the spot.
Simon says a combination of armed men in military uniform and others in civilian clothes conducted house-to-house searches, killed dozens of unarmed civilians, then burned down their houses and looted property. He says the violence has paralyzed markets, schools, and government institutions.
The general situation is very tense. As we talk now, no one is coming out of the room. Those who know themselves that they are targeted, they cannot come out of their home to go to the street, because when they go, otherwise they are arrested or they are killed on the spot, like what happened to the rest of the people.
Father Moses Peter, a Catholic priest at the Wau Diocese, says thousands of civilians, mostly women and children, are seeking shelter at the church compound.
Most of them are women and children, but currently we don't have something in our hands to give them. They need food for children who are just coming from home. And the second one could be maybe shelter, because most of them are many now and most of them do not have shelter.
An international committee for the Red Cross surgical team says it is flying to Wau to assist those wounded in the attack. The team's arrival is part of the ICRC planned project to support the Wau Teaching Hospital in its surgical capacity. A 23-year-old woman who prefers to be identified only as Nonoya for security reasons is among those sheltering at the Catholic Church compound. Speaking in Arabic by phone from Wau, Nonoya says she saw bodies of a young man killed in cold blood as she fled to the church compound. Nonoya says one of them was shot in the arm and on the chest, and when we arrived, he was still alive. She says a short time later, he died. Despite the eyewitness accounts, Wau State Deputy Governor Anthony Charles Mberende says only six people were killed and four others wounded in the violence.
We don't know them, actually, they are from where. But some of them, they are civilians. They are in civilian dress, and some of them, they are in uniform. Sometimes the uniform chef is the army, and another one is the police, like this.
SPLA deputy spokesperson Santo Domich in Juba confirms that the government forces fought with opposition forces in the Bagari area, about 25 kilometers southwest of Wau town, on Saturday and Sunday. Domich says government forces captured Bagari, which has been under the control of the armed opposition forces for several months. It is unclear who, if anyone, ordered government soldiers to attack the town of Wau. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
A Ugandan judge on Monday charged Makerere University researcher Stella Nyanzi with offensive speech and cyber harassment against President Yoweri Museveni. As Halima Adumani reports from Kampala, at the root of this controversy is sanitary pads for schoolgirls.
According to the charge sheet, Stella Nyanzi used her computer in February to post to her Facebook page an insulting message about President Yoweri Museveni, allegedly calling him a pair of buttocks, among other things. This is the third time Nyanzi has been detained in relation to these alleged postings, but it is the first time she has been charged with a crime. The state says she has willfully and repeatedly used electronic communication to post offensive online messages intended to disturb or attempt to disturb the peace. Before the fully packed courtroom, State Attorney Jonathan Mwaganya called for Nyanzi to undergo a mental health evaluation.
Your Honor, if the order being sought through this application is not granted, and it is established that the suspect is a psychiatric case, then it will lead to continued reputational damage of her victims and the general public.
Her lawyer, Semakade Isaac, dismissed the state's accusations.
The defense prays in summation that this court is pleased to ignore the application of the state for an inquiry into the insanity or other incapacity of the accused person, as it was made under wrong law, and that the court be further pleased to invoke the right law to hear the accused person on bail.
In February, Nyanzi took to Facebook to collect donations of sanitary products for schoolgirls. After the first lady said the government could not afford to supply them, President Museveni had promised on the campaign trail last year to provide sanitary pads for girls in need. Nyanzi has publicly and colorfully criticized the first family and the government over the issue. As many as a third of girls in the country have to miss school because they cannot afford sanitary products, according to government statistics. At the time of her arrest Friday, Nyanzi, who holds a PhD in medical and cultural anthropology, had just finished giving a talk on menstruation. She entered a plea of not guilty Monday.
He makes promises of sanitary pads to girls. He goes against the premise. Yoweri Museveni is offending Ugandans, and we are silent. And those of us who dare to speak truth to power are called the offenders. I am happy to take on the mantle of insanity. if this matter is going to be the only time that the regime will be told about its offense to the people of Uganda. And therefore, I am not guilty of offensive communication.
The judge ordered Nyanzi to return in 2 weeks to apply for bail. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
In the Central African Republic, armed groups have occupied, looted, and damaged schools, preventing thousands of children from getting their education, according to a report released by Human Rights Watch. As Zach Badoff reports from Bangui, the country has been in crisis since late 2012, and militias control much of the countryside.
Several thousand children in the Central African Republic cannot go to school because armed groups continue to use their schools, typically the most solid structures in town, as bases or barracks. Aboubakary Tall is the interim representative for UNICEF in the CAR.
That means basically a whole country that runs at a suboptimal level. When children cannot go to school, they end up in the street and they become vulnerable to all kinds of things, including being recruited into and pressed into service by the armed groups. What it means is we're basically building the kind of citizen that we would not want to run into in a dark corner of the street somewhere.
CAR government forces maintain little control outside the capital. In the countryside, Christian and Muslim armed militias fight between themselves for mineral resources and trade routes. Bandits and other forces like the Lord's Resistance Army also take advantage of the poor security situation. Human Rights Watch researcher Louis Mudge traveled throughout the CAR in November 2016 and January 2017, investigating access to schools. Mudge found even if the fighters were just outside the school, the students still could not or would not attend. Some children would have to pass by militia members who killed members of their family.
We found just scores of children who spoke about how this had reduced their feeling of self-worth, how they felt like they had no future, how they used to have big dreams and how they don't anymore.
The St. Francois Public Primary School in Bangui was occupied by anti-Balaka militia in December 2013. They used it as a barracks, says school director Edouard Père.
Il détruit tout ce qui est matériel.
He says they destroyed all the material. They broke the students' desks. Students have to sit on the ground. They destroyed the library. They took all the books. They left the school in a very bad state. Per said the militia was also recruiting children into their ranks and giving them weapons. The militia left the school in late 2015. After rehabilitation funded by the government and UNICEF, the school reopened in February 2016 with about 2,500 students now back in class. But it is a different story outside the capital, says Eugène Lucien Mbondo, a senior official at the Ministry of Education. She says there are schools that do not work at the moment, but the government is working to liberate the schools. The Ministry of Education negotiates with armed groups, sometimes using UN peacekeepers as mediators, to try to get the rebels to leave the schools. Mudge says the number of occupied schools has decreased, thanks in part to an initiative started last year by the UN mission, MINUSCA. Zach Badorf for VOA News, Bangui.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Global Witness said it has uncovered what it calls one of the biggest corruption scandals in the oil industry involving Shell Oil in Nigeria. In a new report released Monday citing leaked emails, Global Witness says Shell management knew that money earmarked for the OPL 245 oil deal was going to be siphoned to Nigerian government officials. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butt in Washington, hoping you have a nice day.
Hello, I'm Lino Ahmadu, host of Health Chat. Join us this Tuesday as we take a look at autism, a neurological and developmental disorder that begins early in childhood and affects how a person acts and interacts with others, communicates, and learns. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voenews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.